Okay. My name is Ann Pope. My age is 48 years old. Today's date is June 25th, 2008, and we are in Foley Square, Manhattan, New York City. And I'm here interviewing Frank Jump, my longtime friend and collaborator at times, and now fellow blogger and neighbor.
Yep. And I'm Frank Jump, and I'm also 48 years old. Today is June 25th, 2008. We're in Foley Square, Manhattan, and I'm with Ann Pope, and she is my lifelong friend and collaborator.
So I was thinking before we came here how we would begin, so I keep going back to the night when we met.
The Lily White Lies Project.
No, we met at a party.
Oh, okay.
The project came after. Do you remember? We met at a party.
Right.
I was invited to this party by a guy named Glenn Berger, who is at the time was a recording engineer, and I was his assistant.
Was it an ACT UP party?
No, it wasn't. It was, I can't remember what kind of party it was. I remember that it was in Soho in a loft, and I think it was in a walk-up. So by the time you got all the way up there, you felt compelled to stay and make it worth the walk.
Right.
And we somehow found each other and sat cross-legged in front of each other and started talking, and the rest of the room kind of melted away.
Right.
And I don't really remember how long we were there, but we talked about all kinds of things, and by the time we stood up, I think we had agreed to collaborate on a project.
Right. Well, Glenn had agreed to donate some free time to my project, I guess, for AIDS awareness. It was his contribution. He worked in a recording studio that was, I think, relatively expensive at the time and just did all the work gratis. And the song I recorded, the rap tune Lily White Lies, wound up becoming kind of like an anthem for ACT UP. It was before Vanilla Ice, so it was before white people recording rap, apparently. And
certainly about AIDS.
And I was living in Harlem next door to Dougie Fresh, which was all the more interesting at the time.
It was a very interesting time culturally,
yeah.
1988.
Yeah.
But I've always wanted to ask you what the early days of ACT UP were like, because we've talked about it a little bit, but why don't you describe it in some detail?
Well, the first ever meeting was kind of like an invitation meeting, like a town hall that you were invited to by Larry Kramer. And it was really my first date with Eric Sawyer, who I lived with for 2 years. And March 12th. It was my birthday, and I was 28. I had known I was HIV positive for 2 years. And we, at the time, had no idea that what we were doing was going to make such an incredible impact on AIDS history. But we were there, and so was Martin Sheen sat next to me, and Colleen Dewhurst was there. And when I asked Martin Sheen why he was there, he started crying in my arms, and he told me about his best friend, who was his best man at his wedding, who had died of AIDS, and he felt that he needed to do something. And I guess the rest is history. We squabbled a lot about procedure and, you know, who to invite and what to call ourselves. And we were a very visual organization. There was a lot of posters and artwork that became emblematic of our movement. And we also squabbled about that. What do we do? Do we put it on t-shirts? Do we put it on pencils? Do we put it on bumper stickers? Do we tattoo ourselves like William F. Buckley suggests we do? And, you know, the rest is history. We brought AIDS into the forefront of the United States consciousness when the President Reagan wouldn't even speak about it publicly. So
some of the things that really stick in my mind are the images from the New York Times and from television of the die-ins. It was in Wall Street, right?
Yeah, the first die-in, I thought I was ready to get arrested. And my mother came, actually. She was there on the side watching, and I'm laying in the street, and this cop comes over to me and says, "Are you on the list?" I said, excuse me? He said, are you on the list? I said, what list? The list to get arrested. And I looked over at Larry Kramer. I said, what this list about? What is this, Studio 54? And
kinda.
Yeah. And he said, no, everybody's been processed. Everyone has their social security numbers already handed in. You know, you just, it's a formality. Oh, okay. I guess I'll get arrested next time. And that was, you know, basically what we did. We stopped including the police in our actions very early on because they became counterproductive, so to speak. But the first one was actually, it worked out.
So when you say including them, you mean that the whole arrest process was kind of pre-negotiated?
Well, yeah, I mean, they knew we were doing this for some public good, although we were still a nuisance and an annoyance, you know, stopping traffic, stopping trading on the floor of Wall Street, which was the first time that ever happened, wrecking the Republican National Convention, turning tables over at Ron Lauder's fundraisers, you know. We were piss and vinegar, but we all thought we were going to die in a few days. So we had a sense of urgency that really propelled us, I think.
It's rather sadly lacking these days.
Urgency.
Yeah, not only from AIDS activism, but somewhat from activism in general, I think. But
it's also click this survey now. You know, people don't really feel involved, and if they're involved, they're involved in a very, I think, standoffish kind of way. You know, it's the age of technology, and you think you're doing something by, you know, going onto a website and joining Amnesty International or giving money, but that's really not quite
Or signing
enough.
A petition.
Right.
And we like to think we're doing something, but it's very, very different from lying down in the street.
Yeah. Well, we were putting our lives on the line. In some ways, we were, you know, at risk of getting beaten up by the cops. We were beaten up by the cops on several occasions. You know, we had the demo that was against, it was tax day, and we told people to, instead of sending their taxes in, to kind of just don't, you know, which was not a very legal thing to say, I guess. But we got wound up getting scooped up and thrown into vans, and I wound up with someone's shoe. I think it was a policeman's shoe, and someone else wound up with a walkie-talkie, and by the time we knew it, we were all at some bar, like, talking about it. It was great.
So you didn't actually get arrested?
I didn't get arrested, but a lot of people wound up getting scooped up and arrested.
Well, as someone who did get arrested in the 2004 Republican National Convention, I can tell you that jail is really overrated.
Yeah. Well, my niece was doing a film, ironically, about,
I remember that,
you know, being under surveillance and having her interviews from a videographer being turned into the FBI. And then it turned out that in actuality, Rosario's, Dawson's tapes were actually being handed into the FBI, and
sure,
she got arrested too. So when I told Rosario about it, she thought that it was all over at the hearing, but it really wasn't over at all, because Dwyer had done a piece on it on I think the New York Times, and mentioned her in the interview in the piece. So it was pretty interesting that a lot of that happens without us knowing it.
Oh yeah. Do you think that there were spies at the ACT UP meetings?
Oh, there absolutely were spies there.
Had to have been.
Yeah.
And could you recognize them?
Well, some people were notorious spies. I'm not going to mention names, but some people had records with reporting people to the authorities about things, and they were there. And we know who to avoid. We know who to... But really, I mean, I guess the word... buzzword of today is transparency, and you know, we kind of felt we really needed to be transparent for most of what we did, and what needed to be covert, we knew who to trust. We did a lot of zaps at the time, and the zaps had to be totally covert, or else it would have been subverted right away. Like when that guy was refused to be lifted out of China. He had AIDS and he was very sick, and the airline Northwest refused to fly him back. So he wound up having to be airlifted by the military out of China. And we called Northwest Airlines and booked millions of dollars of tickets. And then the next day we called up and canceled all our tickets and told the press we were doing this. And the next day we were in front of Northwest Airlines and they changed their policy on AIDS that week.
So there was a lot of really stuff that I had never seen before, really ingenious.
Well, we had to be creative, and we all, you know, thought that we were going to die in the next day, and for many of us, we did. You know, I have an address book of friends that died within 2 years of the inception of ACT UP, and I was told that I was going to die probably in about 5 years. So, you know, you learn to live life a little differently. You know, we think about living in the moment. You know, that's the best way to live, and we tell people to do that, but we really never do that. We're always worrying about what we said 5 minutes ago and what's going to happen tomorrow. So,
or in a year or 5 years, a year, or 10 years.
Well, we didn't have the luxury of
right
5 years.
Once
or
that's
10
taken
years
away, everything is different.
Yeah. So that there was our sense of urgency. We were kind of in the battlefields. We were watching our friends just die hideous deaths.
And those were the days when technicians and people in the hospitals didn't want to have any physical contact with AIDS patients, and everyone was afraid of...
Right. As soon as you walked into an emergency room, they came at you with a space suit on, and you would sit there and triage sometimes until your lungs filled up with fluid, and that was that. But then you survive, and then you've deal with survivors' guilt and survivors' ennui. And then where do I go from here? You know, here I'm alive and I didn't expect to live. I ran up this tremendous bill on my credit cards, and here I am still alive. So you move on. You start planning a little bit further in the future. You say, okay, well, I have a 1 year goal now, and then that turns into a 2 year goal. And then you feel a little bit more, I guess, confident that you're not going to, you know, die in a week. And then you start making 5 year goals. Before I was 35, I had gone back, finished my bachelor's at Empire State College, was in a relationship for 5 years with Vincenzo Ayosa, went bankrupt, and bought a house. So you never know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when I tell my version of a small section of your story to other people, many times the part that I tell is how you not only went back to school in your 30s and then again in your 40s, and from someone who hadn't had a college degree and had been working without one for a long time and been, I felt, somewhat abused by your employer, you with that as the excuse, you then showed him and went back and got one college degree and then another one and then I believe another one, right?
I just finished my second master's in technology, but...
Completely changed your career.
Yeah. Teaching now.
And...
elementary school. In Flatbush,
yes,
where I live, work, and blog.
And you not only did this at a time in your life when many people feel that it's too late for them to make any changes, you did it, as you say, with this health situation looming over you that for some people really gives them a huge mental block towards making any plans or doing anything futuristic. So to me, it's always been this huge inspiration and something that I really try to bring up to people who feel that they are boxed in their life, or that they don't know what to do next, or that they're too old to change their life, or that, you know, any number of things that prevents people from sort of moving forward. It's like a huge inspiration to see someone do the things that you've done.
Yeah, I kind of, when I was 20, well, thank you. I kind of feel like when you're 24 years old and you're told you have you know, a couple of years to live, you start thinking about midlife. You know, what was my midlife? Was 15 my midlife? And you're thrust into this midlife crisis. Now that I'm 48, half my life has been lived with a virus that really I never felt impacted health-wise as much as I was mentally, although I've had other health issues that may have been related to HIV. When I had rectal cancer, that was caused by HPV. So really, I've been very, very fortunate. Not many people have had that gift of having an attenuated virus that really did not, you know, take over their immune system. I knew from the moment I found out I was positive that I had to do something that would kind of leave my mark on this planet in a positive way. I wasn't going to have children, so I wasn't able to, you know, make that type of an impact where I would be remembered by children. So I wanted to be remembered in some way through my art, through my music, and I knew I only had a certain amount of time to do it. Once you're used to living that way, then change is easy, you know, because you're constantly reinventing yourself anyway. So I reinvented myself with my AIDS diagnosis, HIV, and took it from there. So it became more of an inspiration for me than anything else, because you just realize life on this planet as we know it, this is it, what we have. You know, I don't have other beliefs that, you know, that I've lived before or live again. So this is the life that counts.
Well, and I always feel too that you know, you mentioned having been given a gift of being able to live this long and continue to expand upon your life, but I think it goes both ways too. I think that a big part of survival is having dreams and hopes and goals and using those to drive yourself forward, and you've always done that.
Well, I've always wanted to be a rock star, so there's always that chance, you know.
There's time. It could happen tomorrow.
Yeah. We had our rock star moments together.
We did, actually. Yeah. In that party where we sat down and talked for a while, I remember, as I've said before, by the time we stood up, we had agreed to collaborate on this musical theater project, which...
Well, first we did Lily White Lies.
No. I was not part of Lily White Lies.
You weren't there?
No, I wasn't. I was not at the session, and I didn't participate.
Why do I remember you there? You were there one night. You came through.
I might have come through for one of the sessions or something.
Yeah. And then we decided to, I was invited by Kevin Maloney from Tweed to do...
Explain Tweed?
Tweed.
For our listening public.
Tweed is the South of 14th Street darling production company that brought us Lipsinka and other...
Adventurous theater.
Gender fuck experiences, for lack of better words. And they... wanted to do a serious piece based on Jonathan Kozol's story about Hotel Martinique. And Kevin had seen my performance of Lily White Lies in Albany at the first demo, ACT UP demo in Albany. And then he approached me and said, "Do you want to write music for my play?" I said, "Sure." And then I looked at his lyrics. I said, "Well, you want me to write lyrics and music?" And he said, no, the lyrics are fine. I said, "Well, I may change things." And then we wound up working together after I did two songs for him. And then we wrote another 14 together.
Right. It was really in the very early stages of my engineering career. I was still the guy who invited us both to the party, Glenn Berger. He was my mentor as a recording engineer, and he really put me through my paces. He was someone who came up under... Phil Ramone at A&R Studios in Midtown and had really seen some amazing things in the whole music recording scene of New York City. I mean, he came up in the 70s and I started working with him in the late 80s. And so he really, he put me through all the things that an apprentice should go through, like, you know, making coffee for everybody, running around. I remember one of the sessions, we used to work on commercials during the day and music recordings at night. And one of the music recordings we worked on was Paul Schaefer's first record. And so he would bring the Letterman band down.
Oh, I remember that.
To record, yeah. And one of my tasks one night was to go to Will Lee's loft on West Broadway and wait for the cable guy, the illegal cable box guy, to come install Will's black market cable box. So this guy, this Asian guy from Canal Street, shows up and wires everything up. This is at like midnight on a weeknight, and they're all in the studio recording and playing, and I'm greeting the cable guy at Will's house because that was part of my job.
Well, I was so glad that you got put through the ringer by him because you really knew your chops. I mean, we couldn't have done...
What I didn't know, I pretended really well, and that's a big part of the
training.
And
in the process,
too,
I learned recording engineering and wound up getting credits for it.
Well, and it was one of those, another one of those things that it felt like something you had decided was an opportunity that you had to seize. Mm-hmm. So I remember we went to, was it Manny's or Sam Ash? We went to 48th Street and we bought all this gear. And see, what you didn't really realize was that I didn't really know very much about what we were doing.
Well, we were all making it up as we went along.
Totally, totally. But so what I didn't know at the time is when you go to 48th Street, you never buy the thing that the sales guy tells you to buy.
Right.
Because that's the thing that he's been told to sell a lot
to get rid of.
It's not
yeah.
the good thing, necessarily. Well, I mean, what you got was actually pretty good. It was
what I have is still in the basement of my friend's house in Great Neck, where their son recorded all of his stuff, and now he's going to NYU. So all that stuff went to good use.
It was good equipment.
It was
good equipment that still works. It was before they started building really crappy equipment.
Yeah.
But some of that was luck. But at any rate, so we went and bought all this equipment, and then we came back to your house in Harlem, where you were living at the time, with Eric Sawyer, who was the favorite subject of New York Times pieces on white people moving to Harlem, gasp, in the 80s. But at any rate, he had that great brownstone that you guys lived in, and that's where we set up the studio. And
it was an incredible 2 years. It was really...
Didn't Ornette Coleman live next door or something?
I think Ornette Coleman lived down the block. And we lived... right next door was Dougie Fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really very supportive and... when I was recording Lily White Lies, I also played stuff for him when we were recording Hotel Martinique. Years later, I ran into him at the premiere of He Got Game after being ignored by Spike Lee and Snoop Dogg. And all of a sudden, Dougie sees me and says, "Frank!" And he puts his arms around me, gives me a hug. And finally, Spike turns to Rosario and says, "Who's this guy again?" "It's my Uncle Frank. I told you, it's Uncle Frank." "Oh, okay." But I think the whole kick I got out of recording and learning how to record was the fact that I could go on and get college credit for that when I went back to get my bachelor's. It was kind of like my ticket out of the dental office that I was working in, because I'd gone to BMI and did that BMI workshop and knew I wanted to continue in some venue of either music or theater or something creative. And what was the biggest surprise to me is after getting my bachelor's in music, theater, and film, I wound up becoming the sign guy, which was totally out of the blue, out of the Ricketts blue, so to speak. And, you know, it's going to be 10 years ago this July that the New York Times published the Ricketts Blue photograph on the cover of the Metro section.
Ah, okay, so...
And that was the week it went color, so...
The New York Times, wow,
yeah.
So Ricketts Blue really was blue.
It was blue, yeah.
Okay, so when you refer to yourself as a sign guy, you're talking about the fading ad campaign.
Right. Well, there are many sign guys out there that,
yes.
that I met through my website, but at the time I had that show at the New York Historical Society.
And this was this was you developed now. Okay, so now you have a career and a reputation as a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
A photographer is someone who documents signs painted on buildings,
mm-hmm.
and there's an allegorical, personal dimension to that for you as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to remember how that all started. So that was kind of an outgrowth of what you were doing at Empire State College, right?
Right. I had to take a course in photography to kind of round out my degree program. And since I wanted...
Had you ever done photography before?
Never. No. And Mel Rosenthal, my teacher, said, you know, go out. Your theme is the rise and fall of New York City. Go, shoot. And he had given us some background on documentary photography and some stuff on composition. Basically, he expected most of us to have some compositional talent. And I took my portfolio and I went to a couple of museums. I went to the Museum of the City of New York, and they sent me to the New York Historical Society, where they said, oh, we love this. We'll do a show this summer. And I'm like, really? And they're like, yeah.
And how long had you been doing photography at that point?
That was my first project. Yeah. And then, I mean, granted, it was in a hallway across the hall from the men's room, but it was...
I remember.
It was...
Where was it again? It was a building downtown? Like,
yeah, it's on...
An 80, office building.
79th and Central Park West.
Okay, that's not the one I went to. The one I went to might have been your graduation show.
Yeah, it was my graduation show. And I'd done one show in between for visual aids. That's where it all gelled for me, when I was asked by Visual Aids, who documents the work of visual artists with HIV/AIDS, to be part of their Day Without Art event, which happens every December 1st, I started grappling about how this documentary project about fading advertisements had to do with HIV. And it wasn't until I started talking with my mentor, Lucy Winner, she said, well, don't you see why you're so driven to take all these signs all over New York and capture them on film? I'm like, well, fill me in. She said, well, no one expected these signs to live so long, and you never expected to live so long, and I think there's a connection there. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I can show my work next to people who, you know, do really visceral work about their experience with HIV. And it kind of became the turning point for me in that project, and really turning point in my life, because that totally put me on a different trajectory, where I kind of left music and went for visual.
And this was in around 1990, right?
No, 98 was the New York Times article. 97 was, February of 97, I took my first photograph up in Harlem of Omega Oil. And that was the first image. And then Baby Ruth on Delancey Street, followed by Ricketts Blue in March of 97, which was when I had my first ecstatic moment stuck in traffic in my life. Without drugs, you know, I just had a moment of ecstasy while crossing the bridge and getting stuck in traffic. And instead of freaking out about it, I said, oh, I don't want to have an anxiety attack. That's not a good thing. And I just let go. And I learned how to let go before an anxiety attack. And all that adrenaline that you get from the domino effect of that anxiety attack already happening turns into this rush. And I was floating above the car, and I was like high above the Manhattan Bridge for like about maybe 3 seconds. And it was scary and wonderful at the same time. And then I drove to Babu photo and had my stuff developed, and that was the pictures that wound up in the New York Times.
Wow.
Ecstasy, man.
Oh God, there was something I just wanted to ask you, and now
Well, when shortly after that, I started the website Fading Ad Campaign.
Well, and this would have been when websites were a really new thing.
Yeah, it was a new thing. But it was also at the time that blogs started happening, too. So I kind of went with web design and did my web page. And I kind of treated it like a blog because I updated the homepage almost on a weekly basis and added images a lot. But I didn't get into that until I was invited by Word.com, which was a webzine, early webzine at the time, did a feature on me. And then I took their actual piece. Instead of getting paid, they were going to pay me an honorarium. I said, well, just give me the HTML code and I'll turn this into my own web page. And they said, great. And before long, I was learning HTML code. And recently, when I went back for my second master's in instructional technology, I had to do a blog as part of my exit project.
And
that's why
that
I did
happened.
The Fading Ad blog. So now all the action is in the blog, and I kind of use the website as a repository of images, and it's where my server is.
Yeah, the blog is much easier to update on a constant basis.
Oh, yeah. It's much simpler.
The new thing.
Well, wikis will be the next thing.
Yeah, I don't quite get wikis, but...
Yeah. They're going to come.
It doesn't matter if I get them or not.
Even if wikis don't happen the way they are now, it's going to be a similar type of open access.
Web 2.0
yeah.
experience.
And my new goal is to teach kids how to create their own blogs and their own wikis and kind of communicate with people around the globe, because I think our kids in Brooklyn need to look outside of Brooklyn. At the same time, they need to look at Brooklyn, but look outside of Brooklyn and start seeing what other kids around the world are doing. Because I don't want them to get lost in the technological curve.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what made you want to transition from someone working in a dental office who had gone back to school and gotten an arts degree to becoming a teacher? An elementary school teacher in the New York City public schools.
Well, again, I never was going to have children. And we had a couple of nieces.
Not because you're gay, but because you're HIV positive.
Well, because I'm HIV positive. I mean, it just never was an option for me in my generation of growing up gay. Children were not an option unless you were a lesbian. And as much as I did very lesbian-like things like...
Moving in with my boyfriend
after a week, yeah. I wanted to make some type of cultural and social impact that was meaningful to me and hopefully meaningful to other young people. When Rosario moved in with us, that was a learning experience because she was finishing high school and... not really having such a great time being separated from her mom, who was living in Texas, trying to make a go of it, of owning a house there and getting out of the squat on East 13th Street and kind of doing better for her kids. And Rosario decided to stay in New York, and her mom wanted me to watch her.
And so that was when you guys lived in that palatial apartment on Washington Avenue, right?
Right. So she moved in with us, and I helped her with her homework, and I think, she may have mentioned that, maybe you should become a teacher. And then at Empire State College, my relationship with my professors and my mentors were very important relationships to me, and I kind of got an idea from them, well, maybe you should also go into teaching. So it just all kind of worked that way. Just kind of I rode the wave in of just moving forward, and it just turned into becoming a teacher.
And you were part of the Teaching Fellows program?
Yeah, I was one of the first. It was cohort number 3.
And can you just explain exactly what that is?
Well, the New York New York City school system was really failing miserably at the time, and in an attempt to kind of inject some life into it, they invited people from other careers who had done something in their lives to come in to become teachers, and they would pay for their master's degrees. So we wound up moving out of Clinton Hill because it was getting too bougie, and we went down to Flatbush and bought a house near Brooklyn College, and I figured I'd do a degree there in something. And it turned out that the New York City Teaching Fellows took me on right at the tail end of doing chemo and radiation. I actually auditioned while I was losing my hair, so it was kind of bizarre. But back in 2001, in May, I was sitting into classes observing, and before I knew it, I was in front of an eighth grade class watching the Twin Towers collapse. So it was a very strange year, to say the least.
2001 was pretty out.
Yeah. But, you know, I think this was my calling.
I remember going to your graduation at Brooklyn College. It was such a lovely day.
Yeah.
Pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it was a nice day.
And I remember videotaping you in the classroom. What you had, weren't you doing a science lesson where you had the kids take plastic tubes and whirl them around their heads at different rates and observe how the musical note would change?
Mm-hmm. And they also had their instruments because we started a band program that year.
What school was this you were teaching in?
This was at IS 171 Abraham Lincoln Middle School in Cypress Hills. That's where I was placed, which ironically was the middle school that Vincenzo went to when he came to this country first.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
I had no idea. You never told me that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I wound up becoming friends with his English teacher, who he really didn't care for very much and still doesn't, but, you know, I mean, you know, that's life, you know.
It doesn't always turn out like the Teaching Fellows ad says.
No. But, you know, it was a great learning process teaching there.
Where are you teaching now?
Now I teach at PS 119 Elementary School. I teach technology and science to second grade through fifth. And starting next year, we became a magnet school, and we'll be teaching K through five.
And what kinds of technology projects do you do with kids that age?
Well, unfortunately, our technology budget didn't come through until now. We were promised the $100,000 from Kendall Stewart through Asquith Reed, who now just got indicted for money laundering. And that $100,000 has been held up by the Board of Ed because of technicalities. So finally, that money's coming through. So I'll have two laptop carts starting October. So I really can do the blog projects, the wiki projects, the web design, video blogging with kids in Holland, because we're going to have a partnership with Amersfoort. That's going to be our sister city in the Netherlands. So it's going to be a better year this year. But what I've tried to do is model for them with a laptop and a projector and show them how to do research online, how to become critical of what's online, how to cite their sources, how not to plagiarize.
Some adults could learn a lot about that,
yeah.
Actually. And what are the, what's the demographic of your school like? Or?
Mostly Haitian and Jamaican with a smattering of Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Mexico. One girl from Russia this year.
And the school is located on
Avenue K and
Nostrand, right?
East 39th. It's actually right
East
off.
East 39th.
It's right off of Nostrand.
Ah, okay.
I'm sorry, it's right off of Flatbush.
Yeah.
It's right down from the Flatbush Junction, which has been changing before our eyes.
Oof. Yes, with the Target Mall and all that.
Soon
other
to
stuff.
Be Applebee's and Circuit City and Payless Shoes.
All that crazy.
Because we need that now.
Oh. and parking.
So we could spend our stimulus package there.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll be skipping Applebee's and still going to the chicken place with the yellow awning. Have you been to that place? It's fantastic.
Where is it?
Campus Road between Hillel Place and Nostrand, I think.
Well, if I want to eat junk food, I still go to White Castle.
Well, you are a New York City kid after all.
Mm-hmm. And I don't worry about mad cow disease. I don't care what's in those burgers. They taste good.
Well, you know, I think you've earned that.
Wow.